Welcome to Recurring Nightmares, episode 5. We bring you double of horror movie reviews, kind of select around a topic, classy haunted house movie, elevated horror films, if you will. But before we get into them, I apologize for the we've been having typing unintelligible for part of last month's episode. But for anyone who really listens to us but couldn't make it through the last episode, I'm gonna just go over how things turned out last time. So last month, Chris, you nominated a kind of like underwater creature features. We had Piranha 3D versus Crawl, and the way it ended, a Twitter poll went with Piranha 3D, and me and you went with Crawl, and so that made Crawl the winner of effort. So there you go. Chris, I know you've been watching a ton of
I made the stupid decision to made August sharking a shark movie every day. Different was a bad choice, but things that I found out while doing this is the Asylum makes a lot of shark movies. If you guys aren't, they did the Sharknado movie, independent kind of studio. They make knockoff movies.
Goodness, like I was going to mention that one. I was like, don't they make the Transformers?
Yeah. They make a lot of films. Like, they just pump this shit out. They did multi-headed shark movies. I watched two of them, Two-Headed Shark Attack and Six-Headed Shark Attack. They're awful. I believe they did the Mega Shark movies, which are, there's four of them. It's like Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus. That one stars Debbie Gibson and Lorenzo Lamas, the Renegade. So it's been a thing that I've been doing. There's a movie called Shark Exorcist that was about a demon shark that inhabited a person. Like, it basically, the demon form took on the person, and that person would kill other people in the water. It would turn into a shark when it got them into the water. It's weird. Lots of weird shit. One of the good ones, though, that I watched just recently, a film called Bait. I think it's from 2012. It's Australian, low budget. Maybe not super low budget, but had good production values to it. It was a 3D movie. It actually hit theaters. So, that tells you a little bit about the quality, but it was fun. Like, it takes place in a grocery store after a rogue tsunami hits. There's some issues with, like, how that would happen. Like, how does a beach town not have early warning for a tsunami, especially in the Pacific Ocean? But regardless, like, it's fun. Like, it condenses the area where the shark is and where the people are, and it kind of sets up for some fun stuff there. And this week I'm watching the Jaws series. Jaws, obviously, great film. Everything else after that, maybe less so. But actually, I watched Jaws 2 today, and far more enjoyable than I remembered it being. It could just be from, like, 24 days of other shitty shark films, that this one from 1978, like, just seems competent and enjoyable.
It's funny. I was thinking, like, a week ago, I'm like, you know what? There's a chance that Chris comes off pretty kind on our movies tonight because he's been subjecting himself to a month of, like, these fucking low budget knockoff fucking shark movies and shit.
It's amazing what, like, when you come back to, like, even low, like, Jaws 2, obviously not a huge budget film. But it's funny coming back to it and just, like, watching something that's competently made. It's not good. Like, there's issues with it, but watching something competent as opposed to something is just like, what? Like, somebody took one of the films I watched. Somebody, I swear they filmed it on, like, an iPhone with their friends. it was real. And then, like, put, like, shark imagery, like, over stuff. Like, it's like really bad filmmaking in a lot of this. So yeah, it's,
I think I've maybe seen Jaws 2, but as I understand it, or as I remember, it's like the most like normal sequel to the original.
It's more Jaws.
Yeah.
Chief Brody is, he's kind of gone a little paranoid since the first one. Like, he sees sharks everywhere, basically. Like, anything happening in the water, he feels it's a shark attack. And, you know, he ends up getting fired because he's kind of, like, paranoid. But he was right. There was a shark out there. It's absurd. Like, the way they kill the shark in Jaws 2, it chomps on a power line and then, like, kind of burns up in the water. It's hysterical. But yeah, I remember Jaws 3 far more, and it is atrocious. Like, that's a 3D movie from like the same era as Friday the 13th 3D and like that. And it's bad. Jaws 2 is just more Jaws. It's just not good Jaws.
So are you like wrapping up the month then with Jaws movies? Is that how you're
going? The Jaws movies, and then there's Jaws the Revenge will be Friday, and then I still have like three more. Deep Blue Sea. I'm gonna watch Deep Blue Sea on my birthday.
Okay.
And then there's a Dolph Lundgren shark movie. I have that for this week, and then there's a, I thought it was fitting. It's probably not good. It's a film from like 1980 or 1981 called The Last Shark.
There you go.
I thought that was a good one to end the month on. So.
So are you going to be doing this again at any point?
I know. I don't think I will ever do another full-on shark. Maybe a shark, like, you know, when Shark Week happens, maybe another, like, watch some other shark movies during Shark Week. But I don't think I will ever do 31 days of shark movies again. Bad choice.
I remember last year when I did my, you know, for the last couple of years, like October, I'll do, that's 31 days of horror or whatever. And I got exhausted part of the way through it.
It's like, I got to watch a film today. And it's like, man, I don't, like, there were days when I just, like, I don't want to watch anything.
Yeah.
And then the film is so bad that, like, I end up watching half of it over my phone. Like,
yeah. But, you know, what's funny is, like, so I said, I'm not doing that again. And I'm not. But I've noticed that, like, at least this year, pretty much every day I've watched a horror movie. So,
I think when you set a schedule to it, like,
yeah,
like, I'm gonna do this, and then if I stop, I quit on it. Like, no, I'm gonna finish this shit out.
That's the thing, is like, I you know, I'm not forcing myself. If I want to take a day off, I do. You know, if I want to spend, you know, some nights, we might just watch a couple episodes of Mad Men or whatever. And yeah, I guess that's probably a huge difference there, because that's what I notice, is I'm like, as I was doing this last time, I was just like, who am I doing this for? Like, at some point, I'm like, what is the point of this? I'm torturing myself.
So, like, am I doing it for, like, the five people that, like, read my my reviews?
Exactly. But I'm proud of you, Chris.
Almost done.
It's cracked me up, because, like, one, I had no idea there were so many shark movies. I know, like, the popular ones, like, all these things you've been watching, I have no idea what they are. But I just, when I see your, like, last four watched on Letterboxd, I'm just, like, just looking at the covers, I'm like, oh, my God.
They're great. The covers are the best thing about the movie. Like, there's one called House Shark that is, it takes place in a house, which makes zero sense. But the imagery for the cover art it's just like a house, like, in the suburbs, and then they impose like a shark chopping on it,
like a giant shark swallowing the house. Yeah.
Great.
Have you watched anything else in between all these shark movies?
I did. I went back because I hadn't finished the series out, and it ended last year. But I went back and watched the final season of Ballers with The Rock. The one where he's started out, he was like a financial advisor to NFL players, and kind of, you know, expanded out from there. This one, he is the owner of the Kansas City Chiefs. Like, he's actually bought himself an NFL team, and it's fun. Like, The Rock is fun. He's a fun actor to watch. He has a lot of charisma. John David Washington, you know, he's in this too. He's great actor. Like, they have some excellent actors in this film, in this series. It just, it doesn't end up doing anything. Like,
the way it ended or whatever.
The way it ended, where it was going, like, it seemed like it started out like, we're fighting for the fact that, like, you know, players have, like, yes, they make millions and millions of dollars, but they're not trained in how to handle that money. We put them at risk for billionaires and for our entertainment. And then, like, when things go bad, we just cast them off and throw them away. It states these things, but then, like, The Rock, who is the character that he's playing, is, like, supposed to be trying to, like, help these people. He never really does. Like, he states that things are bad, but he never actually helps change anything. And when they set up storylines that could show that he's impacting things, they just kill it. Like, at the end of season 4, he's actually ready to, like, take on the NCAA and fight for the rights of college players. And they don't even touch on it at the start of season 5. Like, it's not even mentioned. Yeah, he's retired from his business, and he's living on the beach by himself with his girlfriend. And, like, then he's coaxed back into this whole world to be an owner for the NFL. And it's like, okay, but, like, you had a cool story going on there. You didn't finish that out. You had a cool story going on previous seasons where, you know, The Rock was an ex-NFL player. He's a Hall of Famer. But he's suffering from, like, debilitating effects of, like, his career. He pops pills constantly. They touch on that stuff, but then they never conclude on it. Like, they just leave it hanging. It's like, okay, so basically you're saying, yes, we know all these things are bad. And, well, it's not going to change, but things are bad.
So, I mean, that sounds about right.
That's reality, but you kind of wanted them to, it seemed like they were going to show that, like, hey, we could maybe do something a little bit better. And they never go that way. They just kind of propose theories that they never play out on, but it's fun. It's an enjoyable watch.
It's one I watched through osmosis because it would play after whatever, I forgot what it used to play after on HBO, mm-hmm. but, like, you know, like, that's, it would be the show after the show that I watched. So then I would be, like, looking at Twitter or whatever. And then, Ballers would play.
That's the perfect type of show. Like, cause that's pretty much how I watched season 5, was just, like, I would put it on while I was working, just, like, kind of, like, pay attention off on the side. So
great theme song though.
Yeah, it's really cool.
All right, does that sum it up? Watching? I think I got 4 recent things here, 3 of them being horror has been, like, you know, if we do a top 10 at the end of the year, I think I'm pretty close to being able to put one together for the horror genre. It's crazy.
I mean, that might be the all that's on mine. Cause,
yeah, honestly, it's you know, like, other than, like, Candyman and Halloween Kills, like, most horror could probably go to VOD and be okay, you know. I'll start off with a new quote-unquote horror film called She Dies Tomorrow. This is from, like, writer-director Amy Simetz, I believe, who I'd never seen anything of hers before, but she's an independent filmmaker. She Dies Tomorrow has an awesome premise. It's like this girl becomes convinced that she's going to die tomorrow. And the idea is that, like, that thought is like a virus that can spread. And so once she tells her friend that she's convinced she's going to die, her friend starts to become convinced that she's going to die. Such a cool idea. And
yeah.
You know, and a lot of reviews kind of made hay out of the fact that, like, oh, this is a movie of our moment. It's really, like, captures the time we're in now. I guess I could kind of see that, just, you know, having to, like, confront the fact that you're going to die someday has, you know, in this year become, I don't know, more prominent, more prevalent. Like,
yeah.
People said this also of Palm Springs, and I almost would agree more with Palm Springs than this. But anyways, despite it being a cool idea, like, this fucking movie does everything it can to push the audience away. The worst of it is probably the first 20 minutes, in which you're just watching this girl get drunk in her house, and you, like, don't know, like, it doesn't, I know because I know the premise of the movie, what's going on with her, like, okay, yeah, she, like, is overcome with this dread, and she's just, like, getting drunk because she doesn't know what else to do, but, I mean, even me knowing that didn't make it fun to sit through the beginning of it. And if you went in just cold, you would probably turn this movie off right away, because, like, you're just like, what am I watching here? This sucks. It has its moments, you know, where the characters that you meet along the way, like, become affected by this thought virus. Like, there's definitely some cool parts. But, again, that beginning is so off-putting. The ending comes to nothing. And it's just, I don't know. It's an art house movie, so much more so than one of the movies we're going to talk about tonight. It made me appreciate one of the movies we're going to talk about tonight more. Like, as much as, like, I would call one of the films we're going to review art house, like, this is true fucking art house. It does not care if it's entertaining you at all. And so, I know it got a lot of good reviews, but for me, I did not like it. And it was somewhat vindicating to listen to Slash Filmcast's review of it, where they all kind of walked away saying,
"Oh, they didn't like it either, huh?"
No. At least I know for one, Jeff, like, did not like it at all. And I think Devendra might have been the most forgiving of it, but I think they all kind of agreed that, like, it's not super entertaining. Like, I don't know. But I just, because all I had seen is how great it was, and so I was like, oh, cool, and it has a cool-looking poster. I thought maybe it might be a little, like, Mandy-inspired. It's really not. I don't know. I would not pay to rent it. I would not, like, I would feel bad recommending it to you and be like, go watch it, and then you'd be like, what the fuck, I want my money back.
No, so you had kind of told me your thoughts on it previously, and then some other people that we know kind of echoed that as well. They did not seem to like it either, so
yeah,
I think I'll be skipping that one.
You're fine. It's, again, it's not the movie of the moment or whatever the fuck.
And any talk of it has seemingly died down. It's not one where people are like, oh man, you need to see this one. Like, well, there was a little bit of that when it first hit, but that has died down very quickly. So
we're going to touch on that a little bit going into our first review here, because I kind of thought the first movie we were going to review, when I picked it back in June, like, I came up with the idea for it, mm-hmm. and at that time I thought it was going to be, like, the poor movie of the year, and I think it's died down, and we'll talk about that a little bit, but
okay.
Other thing I watched the HBO limited series called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. This is about the Golden State Killer and Michelle McNamara, the crime writer who was trying to solve who this guy is before she died a very untimely death in, I want to say, 2016, 2017.
Sounds about right, yeah.
A couple years ago. Yeah. She was married to Patton Oswalt, who, so then, if I mention this, you're probably going to remember the story, like, his wife dying suddenly. And he's in the series a lot. This is grade A, top shelf true crime. Like, if you're into true crime at all, to me, it's one of the best ones I've seen in a very long time. Because it kind of goes into, like, it's not just about who is, like, it doesn't, like, revel, like, a lot of true crime in like, the actual crimes themselves. It's more about, who are these victims? Who was Michelle McNamara? What drove her to become obsessed with this? You know, it's kind of about, like, what It's about the victims and how their lives are impacted. It's about people who chase these monsters and, you know, kind of about like why, you know, a lot of people are like very obsessed in with true crime. It's the HBO level quality production that you don't get out of stuff like, you know, ID Discovery or Forensic Files. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just the gory details. It's trying to tell a story about someone's life. And, you know, over the course of 6 episodes, I think they did a really good job. And just if you know how things turn out in the story, which I kind of did going in, I basically knew the gist of it. That it's going to come to, like, I don't know if you call it satisfying, but it, you know that both Michelle McNamara's story and the Golden State Killer story is going to have a definitive end. It's not like Serial season one where you're like, okay,
that was the one I was going to refer to. It's like, it's like such a great piece of, you know, investigative journalism and true crime, and it sets up a great story, but then it reaches that ending where it's like,
it's kind of, I don't know. Yeah.
We're not sure what's going on. Like, he's still convicted. He's still in jail. And we don't have a definitive answer on this. It's like, well, fuck you guys.
Yeah. I mean, it's no fault of their own, but the subjects that you pick, and, you know, this is a story that they waited to make it until there was a conclusion.
Yeah.
You know, like, unfortunately for Michelle McNamara, she was writing a book about this guy before, like, you know, she was using them, right? Yeah, she was using the process of writing the book to try to figure out who he was. And one thing that, like, man, like, the whole time I was watching it, I was just like, it's too bad that she didn't get to live to see how this turned out, because they got him. I mean, spoilers. Interesting thing is, after, like, I finished watching this whole series, like, he was back in the news again, like, last week. It was so weird seeing, like, more news play out about the series that I just watched. But, like, I guess he was, they were doing his, like, sentencing, and he, like, apologized to the victims. Very brief statement, but just, you know, I'm sorry for all the harm I've caused you guys and blah, blah, blah. And you got to see, like, you know, I saw people that were sitting there in the courtroom watching him and confronting him. I think there was that allowed as well. Like, I think they allowed the victims to yell at him, basically. And, you know, I'm like, I know that victim. I know their story. I know what he did to them. Like, it was just crazy. It was like having an epilogue to the show. But yeah, just, you know, if you're into true crime at all, like, this isn't, like, and you got HBO, I'll Be Gone in the Dark is not to be missed. It's really excellent. Like, I would put it up there with The Last Dance this year in terms of, like, TV documentary stuff. Nice. Really, really good stuff.
How many episodes?
Six. Okay. Six, and I think they're all, like, a full hour. Another movie, and this one is funny. It's called Host. It's on Shudder.
Okay, that's on my watch list.
Yep. Yeah, so when I picked our first movie we're going to talk about tonight, I thought it was going to be the big horror movie of the year. And little surprise film out of nowhere called Host took that mantle in the meantime. This thing is a huge hit for Shudder. I have seen nonstop talk about it on Twitter since it came out, to the point where I had to unfollow certain accounts because they were, like, retweeting everything that had to be said about Host. But even so, even doing that, I still am seeing people talk about it. And Host is basically a bunch of friends get together on a Zoom call because, you know, we're in this fucked up pandemic. And so that's how they hang out. They, like, hang out once a week, and they usually do, like, a board game on the Zoom call kind of type deal. But this week, and, you know, in the movie that we're watching, they decide to do a seance, and things go crazy. So it's like one of those screen life films, like Unfriended, or what was that one? Searching, I think it was called. The entire movie takes place, like, on a computer screen. Like, you're through the whole movie watching their free trial version of a Zoom call. Really clever. You know, I should preface this by saying,
is it only 48 minutes long?
It's 56, I think.
Okay.
It's a little under an hour.
Because I think like free Zoom, I think is like 40 or 50. It might be 50.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're probably playing with it, like the time a little bit there.
Yeah. But that's neat that they kind of tried to match up with it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I guess since I said this, it's not super spoilery to say, but when you're getting near the end of the film, it keeps saying like your trial time is running out. And so like, you know, as you're watching that you're reaching the end of the film. Now, yeah, what I was going to say is I should preface this by saying, like, I like this genre. I have no problems with it. I know when it first started with, like, the Unfriended films, a lot of people, like, had a knee-jerk reaction to those movies and thought it was a dumb idea. I like those movies, so to me, it wasn't a leap going into this. Like, I was already, like, super into these types of movies, and right. It kind of, like, made me, like, I'm like, maybe this is a future episode we put two, like, Screen Life films. I'm already kind of dropping our premise of, like, it has to be from different eras, as long as it's around a theme. But I enjoyed this a lot, and it doesn't, like, there's no fat on it, because it's so short or like that. And it doesn't feel like half of a movie or anything. It feels like a complete movie somehow, even though it's less than an hour long. Lots of really clever gags and just creative scares. I there were parts where I was generally like, I actually noticed I was like pretty tense through the whole thing. It's fun. It's a fun, good, scary movie, and I guess I'm glad that other people now seem to be like on board with the idea of doing a movie like this. Really cool too, because it's a creative like. Well, one, it's the first movie that addresses the pandemic we're living in. Like, they got there first, and it's crazy. It was
filmed during the pandemic, right? Yeah.
So. They got the idea after the pandemic started. They're like, let's do this idea, and Shudder backed it, and here we are. It's one of the big hits of the year. It actually got, you know, good reviews from big mainstream publications like the New York Times and stuff like that. So,
nice.
Good for them, too. Like, it's one of those movies that you'll totally be like, man, I wish I had that idea. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Anyone could do this, but these people were the ones that thought of it and did it. So hats off to them. Well, before we get into our reviews, I'll do one more that I actually watched today and I really enjoyed. It's called One Bedroom, like 1BR.
Okay.
This is one I'd heard about for months, and I would almost rented for months. I'm glad I didn't, because it's on Netflix now, so I don't have to pay anything to rent it. I had heard it was a pretty good horror movie. I didn't know a whole lot about it, and I really enjoyed it, man. It's like this girl is moving to L.A. kind of like to get away from her dad and to kind of like start a new life. She gets a one-bedroom apartment in like this community. And the community is fucked up, and you know, you fill in the blanks from there. I don't want to like spoil it, but a nice lean 90-minute horror thriller with, I thought, neat. Like, I don't want to like say like all the ideas in it, because I don't want to give away like some of the surprises, but you know, it steals from a lot of stuff. It steals from Rosemary's Baby. It steals from The Invitation. It's not, you know, not like an entirely original idea, but like, I don't know. I think anyone who's ever had to live with like a homeowners association will appreciate this one. Just like the creepy, oppressive nature of your neighbors kind of like getting a little too involved with each other and your life or whatever. Again, try not to spoil it, but just shit goes crazy, put it that way.
Cool.
Really enjoyed it. So, and that's on Netflix. So, you know, anyone is slightly interested from that description, you don't really have to do much in terms of investment. That's it. I mean, I could tell you the 800 other movies I've watched in the last month, but we'll be here all night.
Yeah.
I've been buying a bunch of Scream Factory stuff, and just any movie I think of, I end up buying the Blu-ray lately, because I guess I hate money.
It is what it is.
Hey, we're all getting through this pandemic in our own ways.
Yeah. Some people need retail therapy. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that's pretty much what I just, you know what I think it is now that I think about it, is like, I'm a person who needs things to look forward to. Like, and a lot of that got taken away. Like, you know, I like to go, okay, you know, in October, we're going to go to Disney World. And I like to like look forward to that. Then all those things are gone now. So it's like, at the very least, I could go, well, in the mail in 2 days, I'm getting a $30 Blu-ray of some fucking movie I don't even like. But
yeah, that's something that both of us went to the movies a lot. Like, we would go to the theater, and that was something like during the week, like, I can't wait to go to the theater and see like the
new
movie or whatever. And now, like, you don't have that. You don't even have like the simple thing like that anymore.
I know.
So, yeah, it makes it tough.
And it's weird. It's because it's like, honestly, for me, like, something like Halloween Kills would be right up there with a trip to Disney World. Like, I know it's just a movie I'm going to go see for $5 or whatever, but I mean, shit, dude, I look forward to that stuff. So, yeah, I've been artificially creating ways to look forward to things. Well, at least we got, you know, this show where we, like, I think we have fun every month coming up with, like, I'm interested to hear what your next picks are going to be at the end of this. And I already have a bunch lined up for episodes to go. So
nice.
We're like good well into the next year. But let's get started, man. Let's start.
Let's do it.
With our review of Relic from 2020.
When was the last time you spoke to her?
It's been a few weeks.
Gran? Mom? Mom!
She called me a few weeks ago. I think she was scared. She thought someone was coming into the house. Do you know where you were, Mum?
I suppose I went out.
What's this?
I was on the property when your grandfather inherited it. His mind wasn't there in the end.
This is an Australian horror film. It's written and directed by Natalie Erica James, and it's her debut feature. It's sitting at on Rotten Tomatoes, 92% from critics. It's got an IMDb rating from users of 5.9, so a little bit of disparity there.
A little bit, yeah.
I don't know the budget for it. I couldn't find a budget number for it. And I do have box office, strangely enough. It's made $1.1 million at the box office. I think that's a little misleading because I think most people will have seen this on demand.
Yeah.
And I don't...
Yeah, that's how I saw it. Like,
yeah, I don't think that the box office number would include that. I'm pretty sure.
I don't think it does. Like, no. That's legitimately in theater grosses, so... And not even, like, I mean, I guess theaters are opening this weekend here in my area.
But, oh, they are, huh?
But they've been closed, like, so it's not, theaters aren't open everywhere, so that number is rough.
And I know this, you know, this movie was doing pretty good at the drive-in and stuff, so probably coming from that. But, so we don't have an idea of how much it costs to make. I'm assuming not much, and how much it has actually made. But as far as, like, what is this about? Like, what happens in this movie? It starts with a really creepy, like, I think a great opening.
Yes.
Where you see this lady standing in her living room, and, like, these Christmas lights are going on and off. And she's just, like, standing there, I think, naked, right?
Yep.
As her tub overflows with water, and there's like water creeping into her living room at this point.
It's coming down the stairs into her living room.
It's, you know, it's a silent, quick little like 1 or 2 minute opening, but like it establishes a mood pretty strong at the beginning there. And I actually rewatched this because the first time I watched this was back when it first came out, Oh yeah, I should have said the release date. I think it was July 3rd in North America. Yeah, July 3rd. And I, so I watched it right around then, and I didn't want to be, I didn't want to have it that faded in my memory by the time we're discussing it at the end of August.
Right.
So rewatched it. And one thing I thought about when I rewatched it was this tweet from Phil Nobile, who the guy who runs Fangoria, where he said that, like, after a certain, and he was talking about this opening, and he said, you know, after a certain age, every Christmas becomes about the people who aren't there, you know? And, yeah, just got a haunting opening and, like, the haunting thought to think about rewatching this. So anyways, we kind of opened then after that with, like, this lady and her daughter. I forgot who plays the people in this. Pull this up.
Emily Mortimer plays the mom.
Yeah, she's kind of our main character, and she gets summoned to her mom's house.
Yes,
the grandmother in this, because no one's seen her in a while. She's like not at her house, so she and her daughter, they drive up to the grandmother's house, and they get there, and she's not there, and they start staying there hoping that she'll show up. And she does, like, I think after, like, a day or two, like, they wake up in the morning, and, like, she's just, like, making tea or something, right? Like, she's just there. And they try to question, like, where have you been, whatever, and she doesn't really give them an answer. And she's, like, acting strange. So that's kind of the premise of this. It's, like, what's wrong with grandma? Like, kind of like a old people are scary thing, but I don't know. I think there's a lot more going on than that here. And it's kind of like, is there like an evil presence messing with grandma? Cause grandma's like convinced that there's someone that's coming into the house.
Yeah.
Or is she just losing her marbles? Cause she's old and, you know, starting to, you know, fall apart and get dementia and stuff.
Yeah. Is it just her getting dementia? That's, you know, what the mom and granddaughter are thinking at this point.
That's kind of what this movie is about. Like, you know, it's relatively short. I think it's under 90 minutes.
It's like 90 minutes long. Yeah.
You know, and you spend a little bit of time with, you know, just them kind of like inhabiting this house together and what is wrong with grandma. She keeps doing weird things. Like she's like convinced there's like a guy that is under the bed at one point, right?
Yep. That was a great scene too. Like,
doesn't Emily Mortimer like look under the bed and there's like she thinks she sees something there too?
Yeah, she looks under the bed. It looks like something moves, and then the grandmother, she drops something which causes Kay to hit her head. And then it's like kind of all forgotten, like, because then it's just she's angry at her mom for doing this you know, natural thing of dropping something.
Yeah.
And she's angry that she bumped her head. And so, like, she must just think, like, oh, I was seeing things. And then, so yeah.
There's one point where the grandma, I think her name is Edna.
Yep.
She gives her granddaughter like her wedding ring, I think. And
yes.
Then later on, she doesn't remember giving it to her. And so she starts accusing her of stealing it. And I say like a good, like the whole like second act is that is like these types of things keep happening. And like almost at a point where like a good section of this movie, you could say, is pretty much plays out like a drama about someone with dementia. It's got the creepy vibe that it establishes early on and carries that throughout. And it's constantly hinting that there's something more, but largely it is like, oh shit, you know,
grandma's losing her marbles.
Yeah. Grandma's near the end of her life. And like, ultimately, like, that's what this, like, this is a horror movie that is a metaphor about, like, losing your parents and them growing old and starting to fall apart. It's a movie kind of about the scariest things in life, like, the things that I think I'm most scared of, which is growing old, you know? and like being there as your body and your mind start to fail you, like that, like is terrifying to me. And it's something that, like, you know, if we're lucky, that's what we all will ultimately go through, you know. But I my problem the first time I watched this movie is I thought that was it, and that they didn't develop the actual horror side of this.
It's there.
It's there. And so let this be a lesson to everybody. It's like sometimes rewatching movies is crucial, because I came away the first time I watched this back in July, I borderline hated this movie because I was like, you're doing this art house bullshit where like you're pretending to be a horror movie, and you do kind of like go full tilt horror near the end, and we'll get into that. But I'm like, you don't really develop the side of it where it's, you know, when you have a horror movie, if there's a monster or something, like that is separate from the metaphor. Like you still have to have the actual horror element. And I thought that was somewhat undeveloped and missing here. And I was wrong.
Yeah. And if you miss that, then it's like, then the final act seems like I really like the final act, but
I do too.
If like, you go into that final act without that knowledge, I can see it being like, this is totally unearned. Like, where did this come from?
Yeah. And I mean, there's problems I have with the final act too, but we'll get there. But in this middle section, they do kind of set up what is going on here. Like, what introduced the evil to her house? There's like this black mold that's like spreading everywhere. It's even on like her chest.
Yep.
And they eventually like, there's a scene where Emily Mortimer is like looking through like a sketchbook that I think her mom did. And there's a picture of a cabin, and they explain basically the property that they're on. It was like the great grandfather's property, and he had a cabin. And supposedly near the end of his life, like some weird shit happened to him in his cabin, and he died, right?
Yeah.
And they tore down the cabin, and they built this bigger house on the same property, but they took the stained glass window from the cat, like one of the stained glass windows from the cabin, and they put it into the door of this house. And so if you're paying attention, like I should have been the first time, that is your clue that whatever the evil is, it happened in the cabin back in the day, and them bringing the stained glass window over introduced the evil to this house.
Right.
And so I was very happy I rewatched it and caught that this time. I think it does establish enough of, okay, there is something supernatural happening here, and there isn't like an evil presence. It's not explained much more beyond that.
No, it's literally just a relic that had been inherited by this family and is now infecting this house as well.
And there's even a point where the grandma says, like Edna says, you know, I knew we shouldn't have brought that window over. Like she says it straight out. Yeah. So like I was very happy to catch that all the second time. That makes, you know, the final shot pretty cool too. Although the second to final shot is my favorite. So let's get into like the third act. What happened? Because again, we kind of describe what's been happening in this movie, and then it goes like full tilt fucking horror.
Goes batshit.
Yeah. So I think like the grandma goes up, they like send her up to take a bath or something.
So the grandma goes, she goes a little crazy, and she takes her photo album and
she's burying it.
Yeah, runs into the woods, and Kay, the mom, she follows her out there, and they have like a heartfelt conversation where Edna kind of reveals she's afraid of being alone. And she can't remember things, and she thinks something bad is happening in the house, basically, and to her. Meanwhile, the granddaughter Sam is still back at the house, and she's just kind of like, you know, digging around through her grandmother's shit. So when they come back, they eat first, and then Edna gets up and she just pees on the floor, and that's
nice. Send her to take a bath. Yeah,
yeah. But all this time Sam's missing,
And this part, I have a problem with. But go ahead. You're doing a better job than me of explaining what the fuck is going on.
Sam's missing, but she's in the house. She's basically trapped by the house. She can't find her way out of these corridors that
she finds like a secret hallway almost, right? At least it seems that way.
Yes, she finds a hallway that has notes on it that Edna has obviously written there. There are notes that you expect somebody that is forgetful to write down.
Isn't there one that says like "I am Edna" or like it's just like
"My name is Edna"?
Yeah, just some memento shit, like that movie Memento, where dude's just leaving notes for himself everywhere. That's what it reminded me of.
And it's my feeling is like, well, so this is obviously where Edna was when Kay.
You know, I didn't think of that. Didn't occur to me.
That's where she was. Like, well, to me at least, that's where I took it from. She got lost in there, and as she was in there, she was losing, she was losing her mind because this was
infected. Oh my god!
Rapider pace, and so she was writing stuff down as she was, because she was missing for like 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So she was like, "My name is Edna." Like, so she wasn't forgetting who she was as this other entity was taking her on. So Sam is lost in this corridor, this nightmare hallway that just keeps turning back on itself, but she can't find a way out. She banging on doors, and then the grandma really kind of snaps and attacks Kay, and so they have like this cool chase sequence through this weird secret hallway that, you know, where the house has kind of manipulated things.
Yeah, so I think the stuff with the daughter, like the, you know, the youngest one being missing, it honestly feels like for a minute we just become PT. Remember that video game? Like, we're just going through the same hallway over and over. Like, it honestly feels lifted from that a little bit.
I can see that. Like, she is going down, like, she's turning corners, and
it's like, now that I put that in your head, if you ever watch it again, you're like, this is the PT section of this.
I do think at a certain point, like, you know, it stops being that, like, it's, because then it's like, then it starts becoming claustrophobic, where she's turning and the wall is like moved up and like her exit is gone, and so she has to keep pushing further and further in, and this aligns with something that Edna had written down, like the walls were closing in.
Man, you've caught way more than me on this, and I've watched it twice.
So, like, you're seeing, like, the, you know, she's trying to like fit. She can't go back for words anymore. So she's like crawling upside down, and she finally sees that like this mold has left a, you know, it's softened the wall, and she kind of fights her way through.
Yeah,
and that's how she's able to kind of alert her mom where she is, and then Edna, not Edna, in her creepy, gory form, kind of zombie attacks them.
I don't know. There's something about, for whatever reason, to be like the whole, like the granddaughter like being stuck. Like, I didn't find it scary, and I felt like it went on too long.
Sure.
But when Edna comes out of the fucking bathroom and confronts Kay, is it like her daughter?
Yep. Yeah.
That is terrifying. And she, you know, she just looks like this fucking monster, and she's trying to walk and her fucking like leg breaks. And the bone comes out, like truly, like we're on full horror mode here. And I found that to be actually pretty effective and scary. Then you reach like this very unexpected conclusion, I think, because like we've gone full tilt horror at this point, right?
Yeah.
And like they're all kind of reunited at this point, and they're all like basically I think she like hits her mom, like she hits her, like the K hits, you know, Edna, and like they go to run out of the house, and K stops and tells her like daughter, like after her daughter's already gone outside, like I can't leave her. And so she closes the door and locks, you know, her daughter out, and she goes to take care of her mother. And it just then reaches like this really kind of touching, sad, and creepy conclusion, I think, where she takes her mom to bed, and she's like basically taking care of her mom, who's all but transformed into a monster now, but she knows that her mom is still in there, and she peels her mom's skin off. Like, I don't know, man. I think this ending is pretty powerful, dude.
It's gross, but not in like a, oh my God, like that's vomit inducing. She's skinning her mom. Like, no, it like peels away like it should fall off. Like
paper.
Yeah. But it is still like super disgusting, especially when she kind of like, she reaches up and she's like, you know, touching her mom's hair, and then she starts to
huge chunks are coming out. Yeah.
Oh God, that's so gross.
My girlfriend watched it with me the second time, and she was just like, this is fucking disgusting. Like, what is going on here? And I'm like, it's a metaphor. Yeah.
She like goes, I'm going to take care of my mom. She locks Sam outside, and then she goes and does what she's been through this whole movie kind of been neglecting to do. She's always kind of felt that her mom's been a burden. Like that's the feeling I got throughout the whole thing, is that Kay feels her mom's a burden. They don't really talk. They don't have a good relationship. And she doesn't really want to take care of her. She wants to put her in a home. And then this is that turning point of, no, like, we have to take care of our parents. We have to be the ones that are there. And she's actually doing it, actually helping her transform into what, you know, Edna has become.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you know, you have to confront, like, I will never have to go through this, but like, you have to confront what's happening to your parent, and that they're, you know, they're turning into something that, you know, they're someone with bad Alzheimer's or whatever is eventually not going to know who you are, not going to recognize you. And then this is kind of a metaphor for dealing with that. Like, you have to face what's happening to your mom, and you have to still love her and take care of her despite what's happening. And so, you know, besides like the gross factor of it, it's also very like touching and moving ending. I thought. And then I don't know how the fucking daughter gets in. I don't even remember.
They don't really touch on it. She just shows up at the bedroom door and, you know, sees what her grandmother has become, sees what her mom has done for her, and she resigns herself to, okay, this is family. So she lays down next to them.
Yeah, so like at the very end here, it's like three generations of women laying in the same bed together. They're like kind of spooning, so it's like I think the left side of the bed, it's like Edna, the grandma, completely transformed into this creature now at this point. Yeah. And by the way, like just as an aside, like I think really great looking like design here, and just creepy looking. Like they did a great job with the effects on it.
Yeah, because it still looks like it still looks humanoid, but it is definitely something different.
Yeah. Yeah, just great creature design. And then behind her is her daughter, and she's, you know, like laying there, like comforting her mom. And then the youngest generation is you know, all the way on the right side of the bed, comforting her mom. And the second to last shot is the youngest one looking at her mom, and she notices on her mom's back the black mold starting to spread. I thought that was an absolutely chilling, like, that should have been the final shot almost. Like absolutely chilling, like realization that everything you just saw your grandma go through, now your mom's going to go through. And by the way, you're going to go through at some point.
Likely you're going to go through it as well.
Cycle of life. And then the very final shot is the stained glass window with fucking,
the mold is kind of taken over it.
Yeah. And then we cut to black. Look, for me, I think that, you know, I think a lot of people that watch this will have the reaction I had the first time, where I was kind of like, this is too art house. It's not really paying attention to the horror element as much as it should. And it kind of, well, maybe I think a lot of people won't miss the point the first time like I did, but I still think a lot of people will have the same reaction, even if they get everything that's going on. I think a lot of people won't like this the first time. I'm surprised to see, Chris, that you seemed to enjoy this right off the bat more than I did. So yeah, let me hear your thoughts on Relic.
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's these three actresses, right? Emily Mortimer, Robin Nevin, Bella Heathcote. They carry this film, and I think all three are really good, really believable. I think that the storytelling is pretty solid. You know, we've touched on it, like the horror elements are, you know, they're sparse for the beginning portions of this. Like they don't really kick in until that final act.
There's a foreboding, like yeah. there's a mood for it's this
tense.
Whole thing.
Like the film is very tense. There's like, what is happening? Like, where is the mom? Where did she go? Because like we saw her last time, she was standing naked in front of her Christmas tree. And then I really enjoy, like, I think that the third act is super creative. You know, it pays off all that tension with that very solid and scary scene with the mom kind of chasing after them, coming through the wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrifying. And I thought, like, I will take the art house portion of this for like the first hour, because it's not a long film. Like it's not even as long. And you get to that final act, and I was engaged by that. I was engaged enough by the first two acts that I was like, this is good. And then that third act kicked, and I was like, yes, like I'm really on board. And then, like, you know, a legitimate scary scene happens, and then, you know, it kind of turns back, and it has this touching finale. And I was like, yeah, I'm really into this. Like, it's very solid, very well done throughout.
Yeah, I think even the first time I watched it, I was impressed by like the last 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But the second time, I guess I think some of this movie was a victim of the hype around it for me, because when I picked it out, like I said, I thought this was going to be the biggest horror movie of the year, and it was based on the way critics I follow on Twitter were talking about it, and it just kind of set expectations for me that this was like the next Babadook or, you know, something of that nature. And it is kind of trying to be like Hereditary and stuff like that, but
it's a smaller film.
It's a smaller budget than either of those movies, I would think.
And it's telling a smaller scale story. It's very individual. It's very, I mean, it is about family. It is about Hereditary genes and touches, but it's mostly just this story about these three generations of women, and I think it does it very well.
So I think when I went into it a second time, I had my expectations more in check, and then I was able to come away enjoying it a lot more, especially when I, you know, the essential info that I missed watching it the first time, I caught the second time, and I was like, okay, so they did develop what is going on here. Because I felt like the first time I watched it, I was like, okay, you have a bunch of scary shit happen at the end, and you call yourself a horror movie, but like, what the fuck was that, you know?
It's funny. I checked Letterboxd, that the movie poster they use for Relic,
like the original poster is the stained glass window.
Yeah, it's not the one with the three women and kind of the mold coming over. It's actually the stained glass window.
Yep, it's right there on the poster. So I ended up enjoying it a lot more. All that said, though, I do feel like, one, like I said, I think some people will have the reaction I had, no matter what, and I feel, even for me, I don't feel like it 100% works, because the movie feels pretty slight, and it feels like it's all lined up to that finale. And fortunately, though, I like the finale a lot, and I especially like I said, even the first time, I really liked the ending. It's kind of super unexpected how emotional it goes at the end.
Because like any other film, I think, like any normal film, really, that's just trying to get that scare out of you,
wouldn't go for this type of ending.
Kay kicks over her, gets her off of Sam, and the two of them leave out the door, light a match, and burn the fucking house.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Like instead, like she turns and faces her responsibilities.
Yeah.
And tries to protect her own daughter, which isn't possible, because, you know, her daughter does come back, but she tries to protect her own daughter from it as well. It's interesting. So she was protecting both. Like, she was there to take care of her mom, and she was trying to protect her daughter at the end. And yeah. Interesting ending.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So, all right. Let's do scores.
Sure.
We've got on about this enough. What do you think for Relic?
I'm gonna come in at a 7 here.
Okay.
As I said, I really liked it. I enjoyed that it was under 90 minutes.
Of course. Nice. Yeah, I'm coming in at a 7 as well. I will say my initial score was either a 6 or a 6.5, but second viewing bumped it up enough for me. There's a lot of things I really admire about it. I don't think it doesn't quite go to the heights that some of the reviews would have you believe, but I think it is worth watching. I think it is one of the horror movies of this year that like needs to be talked about. So that's Relic, and next we will get into a classy haunted house movie, The Changeling from 1980.
Within this old house live two residents. One of them is John Russell, composer, professor. The other has been dead for over 70 years.
Claire, I'd like to talk to you about the house.
Did you die in this house? How did you die?
Whatever it is trying desperately to communicate. What is it in that house, Claire? What is it doing? Why is it trying to reach me?
All right, Chris. So The Changeling came out March 28th, 1980. Directed by Peter Madak. Written by William Gray and Diana Maddox. Sits at 83% on Rotten Tomatoes. On IMDb, it has a very respectable 7.2. This movie had a budget of $6.6 million and a box office of $12 million, but it would go on to be regarded as one of the best haunted house films of all time. And, you know, I think this pairs well with Relic because this is regarded as, like, you know, classy, like, serious, you know, horror for adults. And we'll get into some of the reasons for that. It's actually something that if you watch the Joe Bob version of this, he spends a decent amount of time talking about. But the story here is, what's his name? The main actor. George Scott.
Scott.
Yeah. It starts off with like his family like runs out of gas or the car breaks down or something. They're driving, driving through like this winter storm. They pull off to the side of the road and he goes to get help. Cause there's phone booths like everywhere. Yeah. Apparently back then, just like on the side of the highway, there's a phone booth. And while he's calling, this truck and this other car, like nearly get in an accident and they like veer to avoid each other. And the truck ends up going right into his family station wagon with his, you know, his wife and kid, like right there. Hell of an opening, huh, Chris? Like, it's just like...
Jesus Christ. Like, that was...
Sets the tone.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, what the fuck is going... Like, all right. That was a choice you guys made there.
I think my note was, waste no time. No time on that opening.
No.
Horrific car crash before the opening title. And so, George C. Scott, he, like, loses his whole family. His friend, like, and he's like this, I don't know, famous, but he's a composer. Like, he composes music. His friends hook him up with this lady in Seattle who oversees historical society houses, and she rents them like this big old mansion.
Yes.
I don't know. I guess
super awesome looking house.
It is cool. I forgot they talked about it on the version I watched, but I can't remember what they were saying about it. I think it might have been mostly a set, or that they built the house or something like that.
I could definitely see like, oh, or like the house itself was real, but it was condemned or something, and everything inside maybe takes place on a set.
Yeah, I think it's one of those situations. The idea that he should go like move to Seattle and live in this mansion to like cope with his grief. I don't know. I guess it's just like, all right, I guess that's one thing he could do. And it doesn't take long for like supernatural stuff to start happening. Like there's a part where he's like playing at a piano and he, like, there's like a delivery or something, I think. And he gets up to walk away. And then you see like the ghost plays a note, like a single note on the piano. He goes to an opera at some point where he gets introduced to these high society people, including like this senator who becomes important to the plot. This is a senator, right? Something like that.
Yep.
He comes back home from the opera and there's like loud banging going on in his house at night. There's a scene where he's like, practicing at his piano and the door to the room opens on its own. A faucet turns on, like very classic haunted house stuff starts happening right away. And that takes up a lot of like, I'd say the first act at least. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it does a good job. Maybe it doesn't do a good job. Maybe it was just me going, this makes sense at the time.
After you watched 18 shark movies.
Well, he's, you know, he's dealing with the grief of having his wife and daughter die in like that horrible car accident. And, you know, he definitely feels some guilt over everything that happened. And I wasn't sure if they were going to play off the idea that like maybe this was all in his head, like that.
I expected his grief to connect more with what the story ends up doing. Like, and it's just, you have that setup and it's just like, it's weird, right? Like, cause like, it's just like, oh, and like very early on, you're led to believe that the ghost died very similarly to how his family died. And so you're like, oh, it's going to play into that. And then like, we'll get into that, but like ends up being wrong.
Like a lot of misdirection for where it does end up.
Yeah, and this movie is very, very, very plot heavy. Like, it's something that Joe Bob says a lot, and I can't remember if he said it in his review of this, but it's something I agree with. It's something that my writing teachers used to say. You have too much plot getting in the way of the story here. Like, it's just, it's too many details, like, for no reason. Including that, like, there's this whole plot that is dropped that he thinks it was this girl who died, like, in 1907 or something crazy, where she was hit. Was she hit or she fell from a fucking carriage, like a horse-drawn type thing? I don't know. But it ends up being that, like, that's not it at all. It's the ghost is not her. It's someone else. It's a young boy who died in the house. And then the details regarding that young boy are also like
completely out of left field.
It's just very plot heavy, very complicated plot. We'll get into it. I'm just trying to go along with my notes here, though. Okay, so then there's a part where glass blows out of a window in the attic as he's walking out of the house, and he goes up to investigate, and he like discovers a door, like a hidden door that leads up to this attic, and he finds a music box up there with a melody that is the same as the one he thought he wrote in the house. Again, like just a lot of details here. Like, did you need that? Is it adding something? I don't know. I guess it's a spooky thing. It's a spooky idea, right? Like, I just feel like at some point they should have trimmed some of this stuff.
It's just too much.
So you're agreeing with me here that like the plot is a bit much.
Yeah. And it doesn't necessarily add anything to it. Like, at first it was like all the coincidences around the house are like, I'm thinking it ties into his grief, and it doesn't. And then, as you said, like, there's the whole, you know, B plot with him trying to solve like who the ghost is, and that has nothing to do with what the fuck is going on. And then there's a C plot that is maybe the A plot.
Like, what the fuck? It's a lot. It's really a lot. And that's going to be one of my criticisms of this, if it's not obvious already. But I'm just going through, like, there's just so much that happens in this movie. There's a part where he throws his daughter, like, he keeps this ball that his daughter had. There's a part where he throws it in the river, and then he comes home, and it's bouncing down the stairs in the house.
I thought that was a, like...
It was good. I like that.
It serves no point. But, yeah. But I thought it was a good scene, especially since the ball is still wet. Like,
yeah, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, there's like a glisten to it, and it's a little bit shiny underneath, so it like seems like it was just fished out of the river.
I did take this note that according to Joe Bob, it took 30 takes to get the ball to land right. They just kept doing the ball bouncing down the stairs until they got it right.
That is some dedication.
That's a lot of film to waste. I mean, not waste. They're trying to get it right. Whatever. And then you have a scene which I think is one of the best scenes in the film, and that is where they do a seance. And I don't know why it works so well for me, because it's just a creepy ghost movie seance scene where I think what makes it for me is like there's this kind of ASMR part to it where it's like the medium is constantly scribbling.
Yeah.
She's doing that thing where like she's constantly moving her hand and scribbling and hoping that the presence will like channel through her and get her right answers to questions that they're asking. And, you know, it does. And like, I just think that the scribbling is effective, and it, I don't know. The scene is just
a good sound effect.
It's a hard scene to get right, especially since it's so common in these types of movies. And I think they did a great job with it.
Yeah. Normally it's just like, oh, we're going to have this creepy seance. And like, you know, the same things happen, right? Like you have the shaking and mm-hmm. the voices and
just,
but it's done in a way that I think actually works better than more modern ones where they're kind of picking off of that.
It's just, there's a certain mood to the scene that really works for me. And I think it like the scribbling for whatever reason, like I'm one of those people that are susceptible to ASMR. And it's like, it was like making the hairs stand up on my neck and stuff, like listening to the scribbling.
Well, there's a believable, like from George C. Scott and from Tris Vanderveer, John and Claire here, they seem skeptical. Like, all right, we're going to let this thing happen because, you know, John thinks that maybe it's good. But even he looks skeptical, like, as it's going on. Like, what the hell is this lady doing? Like, and then, like, as things start happening, you see them start to buy into it. And it's very interesting.
So, in a large portion of the movies from here, I would say, like, the whole heart of this movie, most of this movie, it's like this murder mystery where they're trying to find out who the boy was that died in the house. And there's a lot of details to that too. Basically we find out that there was a handicapped boy named Joseph, and he was drowned by his father in the bathtub. And he murdered his son because his son wouldn't live long enough to get inheritance from his grandfather.
Yeah, so he probably wasn't going to live to be 18.
Which, I guess, was a stipulation of some trust fund from his rich grandfather. Again, a lot of details here. Like, a lot going on here. Then he, and this is where we get the title from, like, he replaces him with an orphan boy?
Yeah, he basically, like, you know, shadow adopts another kid.
Which is like, I guess that's what a changeling is. Like, I remember I looked up at some point, and I think it was basically that's what it said. Like,
basically replaces the kid that died. But there's no record of dying. He replaces this with this other kid. Ships him off to Europe, I think, or something like that.
Yeah. So he replaces him with this orphan. he sends the orphan to school in England until he was an adult so that nobody would notice that he replaced his son. And like the whole rest of the movie is kind of George C. Scott trying to solve this mystery. He finds like the boy's bones buried beneath another house that the man owned. Again, why? This is another, like, this is a perfect example. Why did we need like this guy to own another house with a well beneath it? Like, why couldn't it have just been the house that George C. Scott is in? Like, again, it's just like the details, the level of details in here is just, it's too much. It's overwhelming. And it feels like like a novel, like you're reading a novel.
Yes, so that's what I was going to say. It's like this works. Like
it would work better as a novel.
Yeah, like
I don't think it was. I think this was an original story
where there's, you know, the ability to build off of like the different plot points that you're building up. You could play off of them more with a film. You need to show a lot, and they're telling us a lot in the change room. And it's just a lot of telling instead of actually showing us. And whereas the book, you can let that breathe and we can kind of get character motivations and understanding a little bit better. We're not necessarily getting that here.
I just want to make it clear that, like, I'm not saying that I'm not – my problem with this movie isn't that it's slow or anything like that. Like,
no.
It is a slow movie, but I was into the vibe of it after the beginning. I'm like, okay, we're gonna have like a kind of a traditional like ghost story here, and I'm into that. But just my criticism is there's too much plot. Like there's just too much.
Yeah, like I'm not like the biggest fan of slow burn horror, but like I was fine with it here. Like it's capturing enough.
You know, it's giving you enough like little scares too early on, like the ball bouncing down. Yeah. Like it's giving you enough besides just him moping around.
Right. So, like there's stuff going on. And then like I was fully into like the murder mystery. Like that's cool. Like that's a cool concept. It's traditional, you know, it's tropey at this point.
It's fine. Yeah.
Ghost needs to be, you know, set to rest. So we need to find out what's going on. Like that happens in every fucking ghost story. But like I was on board with it. Like it's just a little too much, and then a little too much playing with misdirection. Driving us down different avenues that are dead ends. That like in a book that works because you circle back, but here it's like you want to keep moving forward, and it's like, all right, well, we just wasted 20 minutes on like this weird plot point that has no relevance.
We have a little bit more plot to get through here again.
It's not done yet.
So John figures out that the changeling is the Republican senator that he met early on when he went to the opera. There's a cop that comes to intimidate him about what he's like looking into, and that cop dies in a car crash after he leaves.
Like this ghost has a lot of power. For a ghost that. But can't fucking do anything. Doing some weird shit.
I think that was something that Joe Bob said. It's like, usually, like, it's confined, like, in the house, but this ghost apparently can, like, reach out and kill a dude driving away from the house. Like, it's crazy. John, like, George C. Scott, like, loses his lease to the house. The lady who got him the place, she's fired from the Historical Society. I don't remember exactly what happens at the end, except that like shit goes crazy.
So John confronts the senator with everything. Like,
yeah,
he has the medallion. He has the seance tape. He has, you know, other information, pictures, and stuff that kind of ties the senator to this boy. And he leaves it all there, and then goes back to the house where. The ghost is now really angry.
Yeah.
John has done everything that the ghost has wanted, but now the ghost is pissed off, kind of knocks him off a ledge. He gets knocked out. Claire comes in. She gets kind of chased around a bit.
Is that the lady who got him the house?
Yeah. Claire. And this, I had to kind of like rewind because it seems like the senator shows up at the house.
Yeah, and I'm looking at my note on that, and I'm like, I don't quite remember this. And my note is just like, senator comes to the house as it's burning slash falling apart. He seems to want to die in the fire, question mark, or he's just having a vision from his own home.
Yeah, so like, John sees the senator walk up the steps, and as he walks up the steps, they like the house is burning at this point. And really cool scene, too, like where the fire starts and...
Oh, and when the wheelchair comes to life, yeah, it's, yeah, that's the iconic scene in this, and it's great. Like, it's a wonderful point of view of the wheelchair, like...
Yeah, chafing after Claire. Yeah. It's great. It's awesome. And Claire kind of falls down the steps, and then that the house catches on fire, and a really cool shot of the... You know, they've obviously, like, lined it with some accelerant, but the staircase... it lights at one point, and then you just see the flame kind of like go down the staircase and light it up.
Really
cool practical effect. The senator walks up these burning steps, and then they collapse, and he ends up in the attic where he sees a vision of his dad killing this boy that he's replaced. But evidently, it's all happening from the senator's office because he's having a heart attack there.
Yeah, so it's just like him spiritually visiting where this stuff is happening, and then he does. Yeah, he ends up having a heart attack and dying while the house like literally explodes. Like,
yeah,
and that's kind of it. Like, and then it ends where it's like you just see like the wreckage of the house, and the wheelchair is sitting there, awesome, and the music box too, and that's kind of it, right? Like,
that's. That's how it ends, yeah.
Yeah, and like, I guess my problem with that ending is, okay, then what? Like, it feels like we built to this ending, which, you know, has some cool shit going on for sure, like, especially when the wheelchair comes to life, but like, what was the point of all this? I guess...
That's a good question, yeah, it's like, because there is no resolution to it, right?
Yeah, like, that's how I felt. Like, I guess the ghost got his revenge because the dude died? I don't know.
The ghost gets his revenge, but also it seems like the ghost had the power to get his revenge all this fucking time because he killed that cop. Like, it doesn't make any sense. The ghost knows who has replaced him. Why is he angry with the kid anyway, with the senator? Because the senator didn't do this to them. The senator didn't choose this. And the senator obviously didn't know either because he... You know, he's adamant, very adamant that he never knew any about this. And, you know, when he sees his dad actually killing, you know, the kid that he replaced, like, that's when he has the heart attack and dies. So I think it's very implied that he did not know. It's weird. Like, what was the point? Like, all right, yeah. I guess John and Claire move on.
Yeah. I'm kind of surprised here because I think we kind of have the same problems with this. And I don't know. For me, I'm glad I finally saw this movie because it's a classic. I don't see myself watching it again. It just, once you know the mystery, since so much of it is what is going on here, like, and him trying to solve the mystery, it's like, well, I know it's the Republican senator. And so other than, like, the cool shit, like with the wheelchair near the end. Like, I just don't see myself sitting through this movie.
Right. Like, that stuff is awesome. Like, that, the wheelchair chase, the house burning. It's all cool scenes, but like, I don't know if I want to sit through nearly 2 hours of a weird ghost murder mystery thing.
It's so traditional, for one, but you know, again, just because something is traditional doesn't mean I won't like it. Like, dude, I fucking like the Universal Monster movies. That's as traditional as you could get, you know? And I could see myself watching Frankenstein again. I don't see myself watching this again.
Yeah, and it's not even necessarily that the mystery is not good, because, like...
It would work better as a book, in my opinion. Like,
I will go back and read a mystery novel I've already read. I'll watch mystery movies that you know, I've seen, like, you know, because you can see different things in them when you watch them a second time, or you get different characterizations, you know, you get a deeper understanding of the characters. I just don't feel that this adds anything by me watching it again. Like, it's cool. It was interesting film. I could see why people loved it in 1980. I love it today.
I'm going to say something really mean. This came out March 28th of 1980, and it was instantly dated less than 2 months later when The Shining came out. The Shining is a ghost story, too. It is absolutely superior to this in every way, and it felt probably way fresher then. It still feels way fresher now than this.
I could see like that. Yeah, watching those two side by side, I could see that they don't compare very well. This would definitely have felt like an older film.
And, right away, and then you have The Shining heralded in the 80s with, like, it was groundbreaking, and it was cutting edge and disturbing, and it, it's maybe not fair because it's made by Stanley Kubrick, who is one of the best filmmakers ever made. And this guy, Peter Medak, was pretty much a journeyman director that made this.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly fine. It has a 1970s classic horror vibe to it. I think it kind of feels like The Omen, and that type of film. And there's nothing wrong with those films. It's just
I like The Omen more than this.
I get there's more. The Omen is a more.
I get what you're saying. It feels like it's from the 70s.
As opposed to, like, you're comparing it to The Shining, which came out that year, like
The Shining, like I can watch The Shining now and it doesn't feel like it came out. It feels like it could have came out today. Like it's that good.
Yes.
So if we ever have that as a matched up with anything on the show, you know where I'm going to go probably, but So I guess I'll give my score first here. I am going to go with The Changeling. And I know it's classic, and I hold nothing against people who love it, but for me, The Changeling is a 6 out of 10.
That's the same score for me. There's a similar point. Like, I could see why people like it. I could see why it's considered a classic even. Point to note here, I am also not the biggest fan of, like, ghost stories.
No, me neither.
So,
me neither, I should say that.
It was working behind, the eight ball to start with here for me, but I thought the mystery was fine. Like there are things about it I really like. It's just, I do think that it's a little too jumbled when we get down to it.
Our Twitter poll only had a couple of responses, and I think that is largely because I think people have not seen Relic yet. And so there was, it went 100% for The Changeling, and I think that goes towards the
Changeling's
its reputation as a classic.
Yeah.
I think this is the fifth straight episode where you and I are almost...
We've been lockstep here.
Dude, we've been creepily agreeing on everything. Like, I think everything we had to say about both these films tonight we kind of agree with, so I'm guessing you're with me on this, Chris.
Yeah,
I give it to Relic, man.
I do as well.
I will watch Relic again.
Yes,
I won't be watching The Changeling again.
I might watch that final 10 minutes again. The Changeling, like, that's fun. It's a fun scene, but I'm not going to sit through that whole film. Relic, I think it tells a tighter story. It doesn't wander. Like, as we said, it's very simple premise, and it executes on it, whereas The Changeling's way more complicated and maybe doesn't give you the delivery you want, and then the ending is just like, it ended. There was an ending, so.
And at the end of the day too, like, something I've been thinking about with these two movies is, like, simple is more cinematic, and Relic is pretty simple in its plot, man. Like, And the type of story you're trying to tell with The Changeling, I think, works better as literature. But, once again, the Twitter poll is irrelevant here because you and I agree. Just so you know, it's not my turn to pick, but next time I pick, I'm going to definitely choose something I know we're not going to agree on.
Okay.
But what do you got for us for next month, Chris?
All right. So, You've been going through some films recently. One of them, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre series.
Oh my god, I felt this coming.
I did not want to go. I originally was like, let's do Texas Chainsaw and then the remake.
That's where you were going.
But no. And I was like, I've been having a hankering for, that French extremism horror. So there's a particular film that kind of ties to, it's very, very inspired by Texas Chainsaw, called Frontiers, that I kind of wanted to revisit. I've seen that one before. I don't know if you have.
It's ringing a bell, but so, I don't know.
It's a French horror film. But it's like French Texas Chainsaw almost. Okay. So that was, and then I was like, I need a film to pair against this. And it's like, I don't want to choose Texas Chainsaw because you've seen it recently. So I was trying to find something else. And then I came across a review for a film from 2018 called The Farm. Which it's a road trip, and it seems Texas Chainsaw inspired as well. So we are going to watch Frontiers,
all right, and
The Farm. I don't know where we're going to end on this. The Farm might be completely awful. I have not seen it, so it could be a god awful movie. But the review I read seemed to like it quite a bit. It was from a horror reviewer. That does not mean it's a good movie, though. So
yeah, true. But I'm interested. I feel like I've seen Frontiers, or if I have not seen it, I'm just I'm aware of it. I'm aware that's a movie that exists. But interesting choices. I've never even heard of The Farm, so cool. I'm down with some Texas Chainsaw flavored horror. I thought for sure when you started this, and I was, for some reason I was thinking there's going to be a month where Chris does the original Chainsaw versus the remake, and we're gonna fucking butt heads.
Yeah, I mean,
not go that route.
We're not there yet. and I think we would butt heads on that one, but
I think so. I mean, having watched them both recently, I think the remake is great. I think the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre is great, so we wouldn't have much of an issue there. But I just feel the original Texas Chainsaw is one of the best movies of all time, not just horror. I think it really is.
It's one of those things too, that like when you go back and rewatch something, like maybe you came away with a different feeling on Relic. Like when you rewatched it,
this time.
Granted that was only, 2 months difference in your views, but there's a possibility, like I come back to the original Texas Chainsaw. Maybe I come away differently there, but not this time.
Without having seen, though, you would say you like the remake better?
To me, like, it's just, I don't know. So, like, I did not see the original Texas Chainsaw until after I saw
the remake.
So I do not have, like, the nostalgia. Not that there's, like, I think it's a great movie. It's, out of that series, the remake and the original are probably the only two that I think are good, but
I can see that. I actually like a lot of the, or some of them, but I think the remake is great. Like, I just watched it. I think there's stuff in that is just beyond disturbing. And it's just really well done. But like, maybe part of it is when I saw the original Texas Chainsaw when I was pretty young, and it had an effect on me. It was one of the few horror movies that got to me. And it's, I think a big reason for that is it feels like a snuff film or something. It feels like something you shouldn't be seeing. And that's something that the remake doesn't have.
Because the remake shows, right? It shows everything.
Yeah.
It shows you the gore. It shows you the, and that's something that I found very interesting about the original when I saw it, was because I had heard for years, like, this is like the most fucked up movie.
Because,
like, it's banned everywhere. And it is surprisingly not gory. Like, they don't show a lot.
Yeah, it leaves such a strong impression that you felt like you saw a lot of things.
Yeah.
And that is mostly due to how it feels like you're watching a documentary of people being killed. Like,
yes.
It's just the way it was made. Like, Tobe Hooper, I don't know, he made a masterpiece, but Maybe that's a future episode.
We'll see. At some point we will touch on that.
For some reason I felt it coming. I thought that's what we were going to do. But I guess for next month we're going to have Frontiers and The Farm.
Yep.
I guess we'll see how that turns out.
They're both available on Prime, so
okay.
We'll watch them with us if you have Prime. And then answer the poll Jeff's going to put up on the Twitter feed.
Yeah. All right.
This might be, if people don't watch along with us,
this might be one where we get the first Twitter poll with no response. Right. It's very possible I've heard of Frontiers. I've never even heard of The Farm. I don't know that I've seen either of them. So
yeah, Frontiers is definitely it's out of that new French extreme horror.
Melissa's gonna be so happy with you for that one.
She like that?
No, she fucking hates horror movies and the French fucking extreme horror.
Oh, wow. You. I'm sorry. Sorry already, Melissa.
I'm not sorry. I think it's fine.
But yeah, it came out of that same era as like Alexander Aja and High Tension and Inside. Inside is another one I really love from that run of French horror films. So
interesting. Yeah, I love that shit. It's extreme, but I love it.
Yeah, I don't know what The Farm holds. Like, that is a complete, that's a complete blank. So we'll see where that goes.
All right. So I'm excited. I like this type of horror. So we're back to some extreme fucking Texas Chainsaw type shit next month.
Yep.
Until then, thanks for listening.